signing that March letter, declaring that he was unfit for the office he was seeking. Mike Flynn was one security expert in the Trump camp who was already well known. Mike had more than 30 years in the Army, much at the operational level, and built the innovative intelligence engine behind Stan McChrystal's relentless counterterrorist raids in Iraq and Afghanistan. Flynn was aggressive, iconoclastic, intolerant of bureaucracy, and impatient with people and institutions he saw as dated. Translating those traits to running a large D.C.-based organization like the Defense Intelligence Agency proved difficult. Flynn's creative mind spun out far more ideas than his bureaucracy could digest, and his inventive interpretation of events, dubbed Flynn Facts by his workforce, taxed his analysts' credulity as well. DIA, the blue-collar, steady-as-you-go, workman-like element of the intelligence community, was in turmoil, being run by a self-described maverick, an atypical square peg in a round hole. The Director of National Intelligence and his Defense Department counterpart jointly requested that Flynn resign about a year earlier than he or most people had expected. Mike left angry. Over time, he contributed to the story that he had been canned by the Obama White House because his take on Iraq, Syria, and ISIS had less of a happy face on it than the administration preferred. DIA had indeed taken a darker view of the battlefield, a somber view with which I agreed, than much of the rest of the IC, but that was not the cause for his dismissal. This was about management, pure and simple, and the decision was made within the Pentagon and within the intelligence community, not in the White House. Conservative media also struck up the theme that in 2 years at DIA, General Flynn had never once had a chance to express his more pessimistic views personally to President Obama. Some have read that as political suppression of intelligence dissent. I and most of the intelligence community wondered why anyone would expect the head of DIA, who worked for the Secretary of Defense, to ever have a meeting with the president. That's just not how it works. In civilian life, Mike quickly hit the usual speaking and TV commentator circuit, and also teamed up with Michael Ledeen, a controversial neoconservative historian, to write The Field of Fight, which aligned radical Islamists with North Korea, Russia, China, Cuba, and Venezuela in an axis of hate against the United States. The work's harsh tone, one of my students described it as a book-length blog post, and its central premise that Islam is a political ideology based on a religion, converged easily with the tone and substance of the Trump campaign, and Mike soon became the candidate's toughest and most enthusiastic surrogate. And he apparently could not see how people like me could stand on the sidelines with such important issues in play. He tracked me down through my George Mason University email account in August 2016 to ask, "Mike, seriously, you believe HRC will make a better president?" He continued, "I have been disappointed in the national security experts and the entire Republican establishment to date for their lack of character and disloyalty to the tens of millions of Americans who want to see DT win and who desperately want change in our country, as do I. The experts and establishment must take those Americans for idiots." I simply responded with a caution about the lack of character accusation. "Honest people can have honest differences," I replied. I declined to add that at that point, many more millions of Americans had voted for somebody other than Donald Trump, and that supporting someone else was not actually disloyalty to Trump voters. Trump campaign outreach had better success with some other retired generals and admirals. In early September, the campaign published a letter of support with 88 such signatures. I recognized some names, considered a few on the list as friends, and also noted that fully three-fourths of the signatories had retired before the 9/11 attacks. Their letter reflected the larger Trump following in demographics, trending older, and issues, rebuild the military, secure the border, defeat Islamist supremacists, restore law and order. Their letter certainly echoed Trump's dystopian view of the current world. Not to be outdone, there was another Never Trump letter brewing, this one organized by John Bellinger. John had been senior legal advisor to Condoleezza Rice when she was national security advisor and again when she became Secretary of State. He was always considered a moderate in the Bush White House and often had the unenviable task of squaring the circle between our tough response to the 9/11 attacks and our allies' views of international law. John had not participated in Elliot Cohen's earlier effort because he thought it was too overtly Republican, but he kept the idea of a separate letter in his head and was now strongly motivated by what he called Trump's continued over-the-top comments. He had also been put off by Trump's audacity in criticizing candidate Ben Carson's ignorance about foreign affairs. John told me that he had talked to a lot of folks who had similar views. A few sympathized but were reluctant to sign on, fearing that this played into Trump's hands and would effectively be dialing themselves out of the game. Most were more enthusiastic. There was a growing consensus to do something together and not just continue the individual private grousing in our email exchanges. Like Elliot Cohen in March, John knew that this would not affect many of Trump's supporters, but his goal here was to affect the middle, the folks who were saying things like, "I like a lot about what Trump is saying, but I hope he doesn't get us into a war." Word of the effort leaked to the Democrat side, and John Podesta quickly asked if this could be parlayed into an endorsement for Hillary Clinton. Bellinger responded that it could not. And although the ultimate letter explicitly said none of us will vote for Donald Trump, some of us insisted that it include as well. We also know that many have doubts about Hillary Clinton, as do many of us. The thrust of the letter was the candidate's general unfitness for office. Would be the most reckless president in American history was the macro judgment. In making his case, Bellinger researched literature from President Reagan's advisors on what it takes to be president. He highlighted virtues like the ability to listen and to exhibit trust. John felt that the best timing for the letter would be to wait until after the convention, when Trump would have formally been made the candidate and more people were paying attention. By the end of June, though, he felt he had to move. He characterized it to me as an ethical and moral decision. The unanswered language of the campaign had already done enough damage. John originally sent his draft to about 20 people, 18 of whom said they were in. In early August, he sent it to a larger group, and again, the response was positive. When he got to 50, he figured he had enough and was ready to publish. John compiled an impressive list of signatories. Although there were a few like me who had clearly done their last stint in government, many were younger folks who had just approached senior status at the end of the Bush administration and would be prime candidates for the next Republican White House. But not this one. The team back at Trump Tower was keeping book. There were no illusions that a President Trump, who valued loyalty above all, would ever forgive, forget, or reconcile with anyone whose name was at the bottom of this letter. One of the complaints that we cataloged was that Mr. Trump has shown no interest in educating himself. He continues to display an alarming ignorance of basic facts of contemporary international politics. Despite his lack of knowledge, Mr. Trump claims that he understands foreign affairs and knows more about ISIS than the generals do. A little more than a week after we published those words, candidate Trump was scheduled for his first formal intelligence briefing. These briefings after the nominating conventions are American political ritual. They were started by Harry Truman in 1952 and are usually seen as signs of our stability and maturity as a democracy. All candidates get the same briefing. Governor Romney got two in 2012 and would have had more had Hurricane Sandy not intervened. His vice presidential pick, Paul Ryan, actually got four. In 2016, it was different. There was absolutely unprecedented media attention, including press stakeouts. Then there were grand debates on cable news over whether or not Mr. Trump should be trusted with classified information. Former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid suggested that Mr. Trump be given fake information during briefings because he couldn't be counted on. Some Republicans raised the identical question for Secretary Clinton. My view is simple. Get the nomination, get the briefing. No need to make it more complicated than that. Just brief. The morning of the first Trump briefing on August 17, he was asked on Trump-friendly Fox News whether he trusted U.S. intelligence. He replied, "Not so much from the people that have been doing it for our country. I mean, look what's happened over the years. I mean, it's been catastrophic. In fact, I won't use some of the people that are standards. You know, just use them, use them, use them. Very easy to use them. But I won't use them because they've made such bad decisions." That last was probably a reference to the people like me who had signed the early August letter, but it still set off some alarm bells within the intelligence community. Since Mr. Trump had no background in national security, this would be his first real impression of intelligence. The IC wanted to get off on the right foot. The DNI's transition team hoped the pessimistic Fox News exchange had just reflected Trump's habit of reacting to questions without much thought. The intelligence folks had been preparing for this moment since at least mid-July. They had gamed out potentially difficult scenarios that might arise before, during, and after the candidate briefing. They put the briefers through a murder board, a mock session where every imaginable unpleasantness was thrown at them. One senior intelligence official began calling friends of the candidate. They conceded that he had little background on global affairs or on the structure of the intelligence community, but predicted that he would be attentive. The official also pulsed the community on the role that Mike Flynn might play in this session. One official, formerly close to the departed DIA director, warned, "If he starts talking, he'll never shut up." In the event, Flynn was active but far from obnoxious and appeared to be most interested in impressing Trump. By all accounts, the August intelligence briefing went well. These are generally broad overview briefings, scene-setters in the language of the community, and there appears to have been a good give-and-take. Admittedly, the bar is low here. Just getting acquainted is a pretty good day. Mike Flynn went out onto Fifth Avenue after the session to give the briefers high marks in front of the press, probably to blunt Trump's extemporaneous criticism of the intelligence community that morning on Fox. In fact, the second time around, in September, Mr. Trump went out of his way to tell the briefers himself that the sharp things he had said earlier didn't apply to them, at least not personally. In essence, he seemed to be saying that he had been caught off guard by the Fox News reporter and that he respected the briefers and wanted them to know that. The second briefing on September 7 seemed to have gone well, too, but then the wheels started to fly off. That evening, Matt Lauer interviewed the two candidates, sequentially, aboard the USS Intrepid in the Hudson River on NBC's Commander-in-Chief Forum. Lauer asked Trump about the intelligence briefing earlier in the day. "Did you learn new things in that briefing?" Candidate started well. "I have great respect for the people that gave us the briefings. They were terrific people." Indeed, one of the IC participants later told me that the candidate walked into the September 7 meeting with a decidedly respectful air, the way a layman would walk into a conference of experts or specialists. But then Mr. Trump alleged that despite the great advice these professionals had given them, President Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, who is another total disaster, did exactly the opposite. When pressed on how he knew that, the candidate responded, "In almost every instance, and I could tell you, I have pretty good with the body language, I could tell you they were not happy. Our leaders did not follow what they were recommending." From an intelligence point of view, there was just so much wrong with that exchange. First, it broke the seal of the sacrament, so to speak. Candidate briefings are not required. They're offered by the incumbent as a matter of good governance, good faith, and courtesy. Prior to this night, it was unimaginable that such a meeting would be used against the one who had offered it. Second, it turned the candidate's intelligence briefers into political props and campaign tools. Third, it was almost certainly wrong. I know the kind of people who do these briefings. I actually know some of the people who did this briefing. They never would have allowed their body language to betray any internal views, even if they had them. They're too professional. They do this all the time. Trump's commentary was pure bullshit. Finally, the candidate's comments set off a press feeding frenzy for the inside baseball account of that day's meeting at Trump Tower. And, unhappily, some of the subsequent articles appeared to be sourced, at least in part, to current intelligence officials, an extremely troubling component of the 2016 race. As someone might have tweeted, sad. And then there were the Russians, lurking in the background of what was always going to be a difficult candidate-intelligence community relationship was the specter of Russian involvement in the American electoral process. We now know that American intelligence was consumed by this well before it became public knowledge. Analysts started to pick up troubling indicators in the spring, part of a broader pattern of Russian assertiveness in Crimea, eastern Ukraine, Syria, the Baltics, and even in European elections. By late July, there was mounting evidence that Russian meddling in the American election, especially in the theft and weaponizing of data, was different in quantity and quality from previous efforts, that it was more coherent in design and was being directed from the very top of the Russian government. And there were growing fears about how much the intelligence community was not yet seeing. The Director of National Intelligence and the Director of CIA worked to impose urgency about the issue on a reluctant incumbent political leadership. In early August, John Brennan got White House permission to phone his Russian counterpart, FSB Director Alexander Bortnikov, and deliver what John later described to me as a brushback pitch. High, hard, and inside, a warning that the Russian behavior was unacceptable. President Obama issued another warning to Putin in September on the margins of a G20 meeting in China, and in early October, Clapper and Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson publicly announced that they were confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations, and they did so to interfere with the U.S. election process. Candidate Trump would have none of it. I notice anytime anything wrong happened, they like to say the Russians are. Maybe there is no hacking, but they always blame Russia. And the reason they blame Russia is because they think they're trying to tarnish me with Russia. Rejecting a fact-based intelligence assessment, not because of compelling contrarian data, but because it was inconsistent with a pre-existing worldview or because it was politically inconvenient, is the stuff of ideological authoritarianism, not pragmatic democracy. And for the American intelligence community, seeing that from someone who could be president would have been very discomforting. And this was against the backdrop of other difficult-to-explain behavior. I know I wasn't the only one to notice, but candidate Trump really did sound a lot like Vladimir Putin. There was always a sympathetic authoritarian cord between them. Both were on record as admiring a strong leader. They've even complimented one another on the trait. Putin could have been humming along when Trump was claiming, "I alone can fix it," during his Cleveland acceptance speech. Both seemed to have a pretty conspiratorial view of the world. Putin comes by his naturally. He's a product of a KGB Marxist philosophy in which the other, any other, is reflexively identified as hostile, created by immutable forces of history, something to be feared and ultimately crushed. Sounding a little bit the conspiratorial Marxist himself, Mr. Trump claimed that there were forces that could rig the U.S. election. It's a theme that Putin was happy to echo. Indeed, it's a theme that his intelligence services were always happy to propagate. And the American presidential candidate routinely came to the defense of his Russian soulmate. He echoed Mr. Putin when it came to Syria and ISIS. His second debate formulation, "I don't like Assad at all, but Assad is killing ISIS," was precisely the one that the Russian and Syrian presidents had been attempting to craft. "It's me or the terrorist," has been Assad's false choice. It's hard to explain how the candidate of a major American political party could have gotten there, especially after receiving classified intelligence briefings. Perhaps some of this could be explained by the murky ties of some on Team Trump to things Russian. There is certainly a history there, and perhaps a comfort level as well. Former campaign manager Paul Manafort did consulting work for the ousted pro-Russian regime of Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine, and revelations from Kiev stoked questions about whether he should have registered here as working on behalf of a foreign power. Before 2017 was out, Manafort and a protege would be indicted for conspiracy, money laundering, failure to register as an agent of a foreign power, and failure to report foreign bank and financial accounts, all linked to Manafort's ties to Putin's man in Kiev. Manafort denied any role in suppressing a Republican platform commitment to send lethal defensive weapons to the Ukrainians in their battle against separatists and the Russian army. Although it's clear that the suppression was initiated by Trump staffers, Trump has denied any personal responsibility for it. The whole episode begs explanation. Then there was Carter Page, an advisor with intermittent contacts with the campaign, but with deep ties to Russian money, oil, and gas, who blamed aggressive Western policies for the mess in Ukraine and what he described as the so-called annexation of Crimea. So-called? And what about the money? Although Trump claimed that, "I have zero investments in Russia," his son boasted in 2008 that Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia. Absent more detailed data, like tax returns, who knows? We've really never seen anything like this before. Former acting CIA director Mike Morrell said that Putin had cleverly recruited Trump as an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. I preferred another term drawn from the arcana of the Soviet era, Pelesny Durak. That's the useful idiot. Some naïf, manipulated by Moscow, secretly held in contempt, but whose blind support is happily accepted and exploited. That's the term I used in the Washington Post the Friday before the election. I admitted that it was a pretty harsh characterization and conceded that Trump supporters would be offended, but offered that it was the most benign interpretation of all this that I could come up with. We didn't know it then, of course, but that now infamous June meeting at Trump Tower that had Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., and Manafort on one side, and two Russian lawyers, an interpreter, and two representatives of the Agalarov family, the Russian fixtures for the meeting, on the other, perfectly fits the useful idiot scenario. The Trump team had accepted the meeting expecting Russian government dirt on Hillary Clinton. For veteran CIA case officers, the offer constituted a Russian soft approach, using people who did not have SVR on their business cards, but whose historical connections to the Russian government were clear. That made the meeting easier to accept from the American side, while allowing the Russians plausible deniability should they need that in the future. And the Russians accomplished several things with the session. First, they established the willingness of the Trump campaign to deal with the Russian government for dirt on Hillary Clinton. Second was confirming that the Trump campaign would not report such approaches and meetings to the U.S. government. Otherwise, they would have detected increased counterintelligence activity from the FBI. Third, since the two Russian negotiators had made a career of fighting for sanctions relief, I think the Russians would have fairly assessed that the Trumps were open to that linkage. Finally, the Trumps accepting the meeting created a potential point of leverage on the campaign and the later administration. It was the first down payment on a bit of Russian compromat, as it were. We now also know that another advisor to the campaign, 29-year-old George Papadopoulos, was approached by a Maltese academic fronting for the Russians and offered email dirt on Hillary Clinton. President Trump later dismissed Papadopoulos as a bit player in the campaign, a coffee boy, according to one campaign official. But it was Trump who, when pressed by the Washington Post to name anyone advising him on foreign affairs, volunteered Papadopoulos as an energy and oil consultant and an excellent guy. I suspect that Papadopoulos was a bit player, but his actions put the lie to earlier categorical denials by the campaign about contacts with Russia. And the episode displays the costs of Trump's say-anything response to queries, a near non-existent vetting program, and the perils of chaos as a campaign organizing principle. Then there was Donald Trump Jr.'s sporadic contacts via Twitter direct messaging with WikiLeaks, likely Julian Assange himself. The younger Trump spread the word throughout the senior campaign staff and seemed to synchronize campaign actions, Trump Sr.'s shout-outs for WikiLeaks, complaints about the press not following WikiLeaks exposés, directing followers to a WikiLeaks website, with the actions of WikiLeaks. Some of the synchronizing came even after American intelligence had publicly linked WikiLeaks to Russian efforts to interfere with the election. There seemed no limits for the campaign with regard to propriety, appropriateness, or acting in a way consistent with American political values. Those with more political or security experience might have warned Team Trump about the Russians and told them that WikiLeaks was a non-state hostile intelligence service, as Trump CIA chief Mike Pompeo later put it. But this was a campaign and a candidate with an almost preternatural confidence, disdain for experts or expertise, and contempt, not just for their political opponents, but also for much of the government they would eventually inherit. That suggested some serious challenges for American intelligence as the news networks began to paint Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin a deep red late on the evening of November 8. It was going to be a challenging transition. Chapter 4, The Transition. During that August discussion in the back room of the sports bar in Pittsburgh, someone asked me, "Mike, in this Trump intelligence thing, who drew first blood?" It was a great question. And like most great questions, it was tough to answer. Intelligence is always challenged to establish a relationship with the chief executive. That's really nobody's fault. It's far more structural than personal, although personalities do matter. The goal, of course, is for intelligence to get into the head of the president, to meaningfully contribute to his deliberations. But intelligence and the president come at this from different perspectives. Metaphorically, they enter the Oval Office through different doors. The intelligence door is labeled facts, the kind of data that intelligence steals, elicits, or otherwise acquires to inform decision-making. The president's door, any president's, is labeled vision, specifically the one that people voted for in the first place. Intelligence is fixated on the world as it is. The president and his policy team dream of the world as they want it to be. Intelligence is inherently inductive, swimming in a sea of data and attempting to draw generalized conclusions. Policymakers are inherently deductive, trying to apply their first principles, the ones you voted for, to specific situations. And intelligence analysts trend pessimistic. It comes with the turf. Bob Gates, director of Central Intelligence well before he became Secretary of Defense, says that when a CIA analyst stops to smell the flowers, she looks around for the hearse. Policymakers have to be optimistic. Otherwise, they never would have pursued the job. So there is always some relationship building when a new president comes on board. The intelligence folks have to get into the head of the policymaker without crossing a line and breaking the tether to their fact-based, inductive, pessimistic worldview. After all, that's their only legitimate reason to be in the room. The president, whether he knows it or not, needs keen and impartial observers, not cheerleaders. The intelligence community also needs to know the character of the first customer, and especially how he learns. President Bush was a voracious reader, but it seemed to me that he best learned in the dialogue, which was always lively and intense. President Obama appeared to be more reflective, preferring to read and learning in the private moment. There is going to be another adjustment in 2016 either way, although adjusting to a President Hillary Clinton would probably have been a light lift. She had gotten the president's daily brief for 4 years as Secretary of State. The briefers would have known her and been familiar with her worldview, and she, in turn, would have understood the intelligence baseline on which any day's material was being presented. It's not too far off to say that she might have introduced her first briefing by simply asking, "Now, where were we?" A President Trump was a different matter, of course. Not only was he less familiar with government, the structure of intelligence, and the global situation, but the Creator had also given him a few extra doses of those deductive, world-as-we-would-like-it-to-be, vision-based attributes described above. He seemed purely instinctive, spontaneous, even impulsive, and although he had little background on the substance or processes of international affairs, he also had little patience with written or even verbal presentations. He seemed to have an eerie confidence in his own a priori narrative of how the world worked. He also seemed disinclined to learn more, even at first pushing back on the very concept of a daily intelligence briefing, saying that he was a very smart person and did not need to be told the same things over and over again every day, itself a hideous mischaracterization of the PDB. Mr. Trump puts a great deal of stock in personal relationships. No surprise there, I suspect we all do. But he does so to an extraordinary degree, weighing loyalty to him as an absolutely essential virtue, and giving greater weight to a conclusion based on who is presenting it to him, rather than any evidentiary trail supporting it. And if all this wasn't daunting enough, the first time American intelligence really had to try to force its way through Mr. Trump's bubble of skepticism, they had to engage him on a matter that was being used by other Americans to challenge his very legitimacy as President of the United States, the Russian interference in the U.S. election. That was a tragedy for the IC, and it created an almost perfect storm of hostility between a rejectionist president and an intelligence community that was there to tell him the truth. So I didn't have a good answer for my Pittsburgh friend's question about who drew first blood. And maybe it just doesn't matter. It all ended up with a lot of blood on the floor. John McLaughlin was one of the best analysts ever to work at CIA. After heading up all analysis at the agency and then serving as deputy director, John ended his 30-plus year career as the acting director of Central Intelligence following George Tenet's departure in 2004. John stays plugged in, and in his calm, rational way, he says that Mr. Trump's relationship with the intelligence community has evolved over four distinct phases. The first was characterized by the candidates and the president-elect's ignorance of the community and its structures, its ethos, even its purpose. There was, for example, an inordinate focus on CIA as if it comprised all, or all that was important, in the IC. As the transition wore on and the Russian interference story moved to center stage, the president-elect slipped into an attitude of overt hostility toward the community. Hence the tweet barrage comparing intelligence professionals to Nazis and such. But intelligence is essential to good governance. So as Inauguration Day came and the needs of governing set in, the new president seemed to more and more appreciate that he had to rely on the intelligence community. Briefings became more frequent as the realities of North Korean ICBMs and Syrian chemical weapons became unavoidable. The first three stages blended together, of course, and even today, powerful elements of each, ignorance, hostility, unavoidability, seem to weirdly coexist in the president's worldview. That evolution is an important and fascinating story. I will work to describe it in this chapter and the next. Of course, John said there were four stages in the Trump intelligence community story. Stage four, John predicts, will begin when Bob Mueller reports out on his investigation of potential collusion by the president's campaign with Russians interfering in the U.S. election. No matter what Mueller recommends, the impact of that will be immense. Presidential transitions, display both the strengths and the weaknesses of American democracy. The strengths are obvious. Every 4 or 8 years, we conduct a peaceful transfer of power for the most powerful office on the planet. The weaknesses largely deal with the effects of massive changes. Changes in senior personnel, certainly, and very often in policy as well, and the resulting tensions. The incoming team is focused on change. After all, they won and believe they have a mandate. The government they will inherit is focused on stability. After all, they believe they know how things are best done. That puts a great burden on the transition team, that body of folks loyal to the incoming administration but wise and experienced in the ways of Washington, to build bridges to the outgoing administration as well as to those officials in the departments and agencies who aren't going anywhere. One veteran of the Trump transition drew a sketch on the back of a breakfast napkin to demonstrate to me the always large information gap between an incoming political policy team and permanent institutions like the intelligence community. In normal circumstances, he said, there is enough trust, or at least a sufficient lack of hostility, for the two sides to get together, close the information gap, and in the process, form the relationships needed to eventually assemble a national security team, always an amalgam of political policy types and career professionals. Barack Obama pretty much campaigned in 2008 as not being George Bush, but his team gave the Bush folks high marks for how they handed off the reins of government. And the incoming Obama team was populated by a legion of seasoned Washington hands who had been waiting 8 years in the wilderness for this moment. It was a pretty smooth transition. Not so much in 2016. During the Republican primaries, Florida Governor Jeb Bush predicted that Donald Trump would be a chaos president. It was certainly a chaos transition. First, there was good evidence that Team Trump really didn't expect to have to come to work the day after the election. They certainly hadn't prepared to govern. Developing policy is usually done before the primaries kick off in Iowa. There is some time then to think a bit, to put some purpose to the campaign, even to identify key intellectual influencers. None of that happened with the Trump campaign. There is traditionally a second shot at this between the conventions and Election Day. There we normally see massive policy teams turning out papers on a variety of issues. That didn't happen with the Trump campaign either. Nada. Nothing. More than any other candidate in the modern era, Donald Trump ran on attitude, not policy. One intelligence senior said the incoming team was as weakly anchored on facts and on the artifacts of governance as any he had ever seen. While quick to point out that he wasn't talking about everybody, he added that he saw some of the wackiest stuff he'd ever seen during any transition. Another senior observed that the new team was so ignorant of the institutions and processes of government, it seemed like the Wild West. That meant that in November 2016, the demands of manning a government, the usual transition task, were compounded with the demands to decide with some specificity what the new government actually intended to do and how they intended to do it. The chaos was aggravated by the de facto excommunication of 172 experienced foreign policy specialists who had signed those letters condemning Trump in March and August 2016, plus some 75 retired diplomats who had signed a similar letter in September, describing Trump as entirely unqualified to serve as president and commander-in-chief. All that left a pretty thin bench to call on. Then there was the chasm of distrust that Team Trump brought with it to the transition. Trump had run, after all, on a promise to drain the Washington swamp. And it was the swamp dwellers who were putting together the briefing books and trying to schedule meetings and to identify their counterparts on the incoming team. One senior intelligence official told me that those closest to the candidate seemed to believe that inherently governmental structures were second tier compared to the private sector, hence the lack of interest in the structure and processes of the intelligence community. Mike Flynn could have been a bridge, but the putative National Security Advisor seemed more and more alienated from the community to which he once belonged. His views on al-Qaeda and ISIS were increasingly radicalized, his words on the outgoing administration increasingly condemnatory, and his zeal to restructure the intelligence community, with a special emphasis on CIA, increasingly obvious. At the policy level, the far-right news and opinion website Breitbart seemed to enjoy an outsized influence. Its former executive chair, Steve Bannon, was now chief strategist and senior counselor, and he would later surprise no one when he promised to battle tirelessly for the deconstruction of the administrative state. Closer to the intelligence community, Bannon acolyte Sebastian Gorka, who had been editor for national security affairs at Breitbart, met with Trump as early as 2015 and provided the soon-to-be candidate with a variety of position papers on Islam and terrorism. One intelligence insider confided to me that Gorka was viewed as weak on analysis, someone who had made his mark as a grenade thrower, purposefully provocative, committed to ideologically driven disruption, and in the vanguard of the No Peace with Islam movement. All of this had the air of a hostile corporate takeover. I have also heard it compared within the intelligence community to explorers landing in a suspicious and hostile environment, looking to make alliances with some tribes in order to subdue all the others. Resistance to the ways of the incoming team was quickly identified as evidence of the deep state, a phrase previously used to describe murky military and security power centers that secretly worked to thwart the democratic will in countries like Turkey. Trump supporters like Breitbart News and Fox News' Sean Hannity made frequent references to it. Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker, said, "Of course the deep state exists. They create a lie, spread a lie, fail to check the lie, and then deny that they were behind the lie." The Russians were happy to push a version of this idea, too. Julia Yaffe, the Russian-born American journalist, told a crowd of security specialists at Aspen that Russia liked Trump and wanted to circumvent the mostly hostile or at least suspicious American national security establishment. She colorfully described the Russian view as Trump being Gulliver, tied down by an army of American establishment Lilliputians. The issue created really odd bedfellows. Self-described advocacy journalist Glenn Greenwald joined in against the neoliberal and neoconservative guardians of the current consensus, with their sprawling network of agencies, think tanks, and media outlets, and then railed against the unelected agenda of National Security Advisor Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster and Homeland Security Secretary and later White House Chief of Staff Marine General John Kelly. "I have worked in intelligence for over three decades. I know what anti-democratic forces look like. I have seen them in multiple foreign countries. There is no deep state in the American Republic. There is merely the state, or as I characterize it, career professionals doing their best within the rule of law. Not that they always play nice or quietly sit in their cubicles waiting to be called on. Many of the leaks that have plagued the Trump administration have come from internal White House factions vying for advantage, but there is no doubt that some have come from career professionals. My journalist friends admit to me in a generalized sort of way that a lot of folks are certainly more willing to talk to them." That can be bad, but painting this as a dystopian government universe inhabited by secret malevolent forces is simply inaccurate. Trump routinely defines himself against caricatured enemies. Mexicans are murderers and rapists. Intelligence professionals are Nazis. Immigrants are deeply unfair. Refugees are dangerous. And Muslims hate us. Now the organs of the government that he was about to inherit were the secret, anti-democratic, all-powerful, conspiratorial, deep state. It is not a particularly useful description. Frankly, one that enhanced rather than dampened internal opposition, and one especially ill-suited to effective governance. On several occasions, when I have made such remarks, folks recommended that I read Michael J. Glennon. Glennon laid out a kinder, gentler deep state theory in a 2014 article, National Security and Double Government, explicitly dismissing secret collusion and some dark plot, but nonetheless expressing deep concern about the anti-democratic effects of America's national security establishment. Glennon bases his theory on the writings of 19th century British journalist Walter Bagehot, widely credited as editor of The Economist with pushing that magazine to political prominence. Glennon cites Bagehot's reflections on British government, where he describes dual institutions, one public and the other concealed, evolving side by side to maximize both legitimacy and efficiency. Dignified institutions like the monarchy and the House of Lords gave legitimacy to efficient institutions like the House of Commons and the Cabinet that actually did the real work of government. Glennon transfers this duality to the modern American government. He labels our dignified institutions as Madisonian, the courts, Congress, and the executive that draw their powers from constitutional processes. These bodies are dignified and public, fulfilling necessary forms, endorsing decisions, and granting authority and legitimacy to governing. But in our foreign and security policy, he says, we are more and more actually governed by the Trumanite entities that comprise our national security structure. Trumanite, of course, refers to the internationalist consensus that has governed American policy since 1947. Glennon sees these bodies as opaque but efficient, making decisions anchored in expertise and focusing on substance. Glennon believes that the Trumanite network survives by living in the Madisonian institution's glow, but he also sees effective Madisonian control as fading, largely a product of the growing complexity of security issues, as well as an increasingly ill-informed electorate and political class. He supports his argument by demonstrating the continuity in counterterrorism, surveillance, and other policies between presidents as different as George Bush and Barack Obama, and the strong carryover of personnel from one administration to the next. The Trumanites still determine things, even as the Madisonians swap out, he reasons. Of course, the apparent continuity could simply reflect limited options in the face of hard international realities, and personnel staying in place, the admirable depoliticization of key jobs like chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or director of the FBI. Glennon also overachieves in his description of Trumanite control and initiative. His account of expanding electronic surveillance after 9/11, for example, is inaccurate in what was done and in who first pushed it. Still, Glennon raises serious questions, does not feel compelled to create villains or ill intent where none exists, and makes an effort to prove his case. This sets him apart from the reflexive conspiracy-mongering crowd that identifies opposition to any Trump initiative as proof of malevolent intent by a unified cabal committed to overturning the results of the election. There is no doubt that large bureaucracies are set in their ways, and I can aver from personal experience that it is hard to get them to change course. But the deep state calumny is neither accurate nor useful, and all it did was to harden the lines that presidential transitions are designed to soften and eventually merge. To make matters worse, the pure mechanics of this transition were awful. Take communication. The transition would happen in Washington, but decision-making was still tightly held at Trump Tower in New York. Even after a formal intelligence transition team was stood up in Washington, it was the view of the intelligence community that New York was still a powerful, controlling, distant, and not particularly communicative lord. A lot of intelligence veterans were encouraged that former Congressman Mike Rogers had the national security portfolio under New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's overall transition effort. Rogers had been head of the House Intelligence Committee, was a known and trusted quantity, and got high marks for his knowledgeable and bipartisan leadership of the committee with Maryland Democrat Dutch Ruppersberger. I cornered Rogers a week after the election during a party he was hosting at his house for America Abroad Media, an organization that promotes American values and popular culture overseas. And that night was hosting the cast and writers of Homeland, Showtime's hit CIA drama. I began to tell Rogers how much we in the community were counting on him as a bridge and a voice of reason when he interrupted to tell me that he was no longer with the campaign. That wasn't very comforting. Rogers didn't volunteer a reason, but he had been attached to Christie, who himself was being shoved off the island, erasing what little preparation for governing that the Trump team had done. Rogers wasn't really part of any of the evolving administration power centers, and Republican hardliners, who were in the ascendancy at that moment, had never forgiven him for what the intelligence community had viewed as his committee's reasonable report on Benghazi. Retired Army Lieutenant General Ron Burgess, Mike Flynn's predecessor at the Defense Intelligence Agency, had been quietly assembling an intelligence transition team tucked under Rogers' larger national security effort. Burgess had retired to a comfortable position at his alma mater, Auburn, but had been asked by his friend, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, Trump establishment Republican supporter number 00001, to lend his effort to the transition. More to prevent harm than to advance any agenda, Ron agreed. Burgess put together an impressive team of non-letter-signing IC veterans, bided his time until the election, and then orchestrated a 20-page paper on the things that the incoming administration should look at in the intelligence community. Ron told me that it was what any of us would have told any incoming administration. What was going well, where challenges remained, even prosaic questions like the right number of senior intelligence executives. With Mike Rogers out at the top, the buzz at Washington Transition Headquarters was that Burgess could step up to head the national security portfolio, something that he did not seek and made clear that he would not accept. No matter, within a few days, Mike Flynn descended on the Washington office from the New York campaign headquarters, set up his own team and meeting schedule, and effectively froze Burgess out of the process. Burgess, already wary of Flynn, quietly informed Sessions and Vice President-elect Pence that he would be leaving and returned home to Alabama, unsure if anyone had actually read the paper his team had prepared. All transitions tend chaotic. 2 weeks after the election, this one was chaos on steroids. On Monday of Thanksgiving week, for example, the president-elect appeared in a video announcing his day one plans in office. The video was clearly designed to sustain some political momentum and to fill the news void over the long holiday weekend. As part of his list, Trump promised to rip up the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, which he later did. The president-elect also said that he would direct the Defense Department and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to develop a comprehensive plan to protect America's vital infrastructure from cyber attacks and all other forms of attacks. No one currently or formerly in government had any idea what this meant. It bypassed the Department of Homeland Security's statutory responsibility to protect critical infrastructure and put America's armed forces in an unusual and likely illegal domestic defense role. A transition senior later told me that somebody just said, "We gotta say cyber, and it's gotta sound tough." The team went into what he described as campaign mode and drafted the statement based on their gut. Thankfully, the idea was never heard of again. I suspect that the Department of Defense and the Joint Staff made sure that it died a quick and inglorious death. There was one important and notable exception to the transition chaos: the nomination of Mike Pompeo to be the director of CIA, and the process that secured Pompeo's confirmation from the Senate. This was especially impressive since 3 days after the president-elect deconstructed his transition team, with nothing in place to replace it, he announced that the Kansas Tea Party Republican would be his man at Langley. One senses the hand of Vice President-elect Pence in this surprisingly early pick. Pence had had confidence in the now-departed Ron Burgess, former DIA chief, and had actually urged him to stay on despite the reshuffling of the security team. Now he seemed uncomfortable with Flynn's sudden ascendancy, a condition that did not improve with time. Indeed, within 3 months, Flynn would be fired from his national security advisor post for lying to Pence. Pompeo could act as a counterweight, or at least deny the CIA post to a Flynn acolyte, a choice that would almost certainly have turned the agency and much of the IC into a war zone. Pence knew Pompeo from their time together in the House, and Pence, who once said that he was a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order, found in Pompeo a kindred spirit who also fit that description. As a member of the House Intelligence Committee, Pompeo had taken an uncompromising and politically high-profile position, condemning Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration for the 2012 terrorist attack in Benghazi. It was a bone he had locked his jaws around and would not let go of. He was also reliably and publicly hawkish on hot-button issues like surveillance, detentions, and interrogations. But while he was filling the public political role of a tough Tea Party Republican, Pompeo earned high marks from intelligence professionals for his serious study of their work. He visited multiple stations, asked good questions, and stayed late. Shortly after his nomination had been announced, Pompeo began contacting his predecessors in the CIA post. I met with him privately in his congressional office for over an hour and was impressed with his genuine enthusiasm for the job. He seemed to understand the challenges of the task, but he wasn't intimidated by them either. Since the director-designate was a West Point graduate and had spent 6 years on active duty as a cavalry officer, I asked him if his wife intended to be active at the agency. Although it is never required, at least not in the modern age, military spouses often sacrifice a great deal of their time and energy on behalf of the command. Once he confirmed that she did indeed want to be involved at the agency, I offered that my wife had also played that role and volunteered that she would be happy to talk with her about it. I was impressed that Susan Pompeo was in my kitchen that afternoon for an extended conversation with my wife, Janine. Pompeo's confirmation team was led by two Bush administration veterans, Ben Powell, former associate White House counsel and general counsel for the Director of National Intelligence, and Juan Zarate, former deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism and first ever assistant secretary of the treasury for terrorist financing and financial crimes. Neither man could be viewed as a Trump partisan, but neither had signed any Never Trump letters. Neither had ambitions to serve in the Trump administration. Their team was focused, pragmatic, and largely autonomous within the larger transition kerfuffle. They also intentionally held back, letting the agency tell its own story to the DCIA designate, in effect letting the agency adopt him as their own. They coached the nominee smoothly through the Senate confirmation process. Even though candidate Trump had talked about bringing back waterboarding and more, and Pompeo, as a congressman, had advocated tougher interrogations, at his hearing, he wisely noted current law, said he would abide by it, and promised to come back to Congress for changes if he felt that his current authorities were insufficient to keep America safe. He even committed to disobeying any order to resume waterboarding. This was very different from other aspects of the transition. Simple, non-ideological, pragmatic, successful. The Pompeo confirmation team made some other important contributions. They counseled Pompeo to get out of the car alone when he arrived at Langley. In other words, don't bring congressional staff with you. Depend on the team you are inheriting. I don't think Pompeo needed much coaching on that. He had already developed a healthy respect for the agency. Powell, Zarate, and team also insisted that Pompeo pick a deputy from within the organization, almost a given since Pompeo had no experience at Langley. They then recommended a specific agency veteran, Gina Haspel. Gina was an inspired choice. The agency exhaled when Pompeo was nominated. When Gina was announced, they exulted. I was certainly heartened when informally approached by the transition team for my views on the choice. The agency's bland press release noted Gina's 30 years of service, work as chief of station, and a stint working counterterrorism. Actually, her duties had taken her